I am nature. I am energy. I am love. I'm a spiritual being. I'm an emotional being. I'm a physical being. Most of all, I'm a human being becoming a humane being. Yes, indeed, we are nature. Hello. Welcome to my podcast, Our Original Brain in Modern Life. My name is Gwen, and what I'd like to talk to you about today is my favorite subject. I call it, why do we do as we do? I believe we do as we do because our brain drives our behavior, not the other way around. So what can we do about our brain driving us and us not driving us? Please join me as I describe some of the processes of how this occurs, what we can do to change, how we can learn to drive us, not the other way around. Each of these podcasts are in written form under articles at my blog, Our Original Brain in Modern Life.blog. Here you will find all the podcasts and the articles associated with them that I have written. Please read them if you'd like. You may find the pictures helpful for your understanding. You're welcome to print and share them. There is also a forum where you can share your thoughts, your feelings, contemplations about what you've just listened to. Let me not forget, for all you animal lovers, ever want to talk with your animal companion? Please visit my website, gwenshumanandanimaltherapy.com. Namaste. Let me give you an overview of this podcast. In this podcast, I will discuss basic human emotional needs and their intersection with culture, genetics, structure determines function, where emotions originate, the limbic system and the HPA axis, the lobes of the brain, and how we can find peace in life. This container of ours must survive because our bodies are containers for our energetic spirit. That means this body of ours needs to be nurtured and cared for with food, elimination, reproduction, protection from the elements, predators. This requires a CEO to run us. That is our brain. Our brain drives our behavior to function in a stimulus-response manner. We're designed to react, not act. This modus operandi allowed us to use less energy. When we lived nomadically, we had a less reliable food resource. We had to conserve energy, and our brain used a lot of energy. Because our brain works automatically, it never sleeps. Even in sleep, our body is repairing, restoring, manufacturing everything we need to keep alive. Our brain controls our actions, and humans can function like a patella reflex as a result, simply reacting and reacting. If this fits you in any way, let me say, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just human. The beautiful thing about being human is we have free will. We can decide how we want to behave. If it's not consistent with who we are, we can always change and be different. Change is slow, takes endless commitment, and a lot of trial and error. How do we change? We change by reflecting, contemplating, examining, and asking ourselves, why do we do as we do? It is important when we ask ourselves that question, we keep an open mind and have a willingness to self-examine, to accept what comes up, to look at it. The biggest hurdle is to ignore our mind. Our mind is that part of our brain that will send us a message that will try and convince us that there's something wrong with us. The more we pay attention to ourselves, the more we become aware of to what we're feeling, how our feelings are our internal sensation to an external event, understand how the past and the present are intersecting, the more we can understand ourselves. It's very important to understand our current life and the history of who we are. This will give us greater peace and potential understanding. But it only starts with us asking ourselves the question, why do I do as I do? Some questions to consider are, do I behave in a manner I think I should in order to be liked? Or is it consistent with who I am? We're all hardwired to desire to be a part of the group, to be a part of the tribe, to be accepted for who we are by others, to be seen for who we are by others. These are basic human needs. But I do wonder, what is the cost of acting how you think you should to be liked by others? A psychologist named Abraham Maslow made a pyramid called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. The pyramid represents levels of self-development. The stage below needs to be satisfied before the stage above can be satisfied. For example, you probably couldn't pursue a family, intimacy, or friends as readily if you didn't have a home. The need for belongingness is an emotional need to affiliate with and be accepted by members of a group. Our need to belong is a primary social need, as we are social animals. When we lived outside, more hazards existed, and being part of the group increased our chance of survival. Our need to belong is reflected by our need to avoid rejection and feel approved by others. This need can be influential in our daily behavior. This is where the word should exists and leads to feelings of social obligation. Have you felt an unspoken pressure to do something? Maybe it was to attend a social event or give a gift. Maybe your parents taught you that you shouldn't say certain things about others. Children learn to ignore their natural inclinations at a young age because they fear rejection. Maybe it could be by your peer group. Maybe it was a teacher or a parent. Children raised like this is what Karen Horney calls the tyranny of the shoulds. You should do this, you should do that. If you're reared like that and you feel a lot of social pressure to behave in a certain way as an adult, you probably have lost your natural tendency to be curious, to be open, to be hopeful, to want to self-examine and learn about yourself. This is the same curiosity that led us to leave Africa and explore Asia and eventually populate 90% of the planet. That aspect of ourselves can be reawakened. In my third semester of college, I learned about humanistic psychology. Humanistic psychology, as I was taught it, was largely Dr. Abraham Maslow and Dr. Carl Rogers. I was introduced to the work of Dr. Carl Rogers by my teacher drawing two circles on the board. One was a smaller circle, the other was a larger circle. He explained that the smaller circle was true I and the bigger circle was other I. He stated that humans had a need for positive regard, love and affection, and that most humans received conditional positive regard and raised by caregivers who rule under the tyranny of the shoulds. I will love you if you act this way. I will love you if you're interested in X, Y, and Z, but not A, B, and C. When raised under the tyranny of the shoulds, someone can learn to abandon their curiosity. The person can then live an inauthentic life doing what they think they should to get approval, to get acceptance, not what feels true to them. For example, if you were raised in a home where you lived under the tyranny of the shoulds and you thought you had to go to college to pursue a certain career that you thought your parents wanted you to have, once you have that career, you will expect that you will gain their love and acceptance. That isn't always the case. And I think the outcome of living like this is that you will decide you have not chosen a career that you like. You may realize that you're living your life to be accepted by others. You're feeling dissatisfied with life. This is a recipe leading one to judge oneself and others. How often do you reject what someone says or does based upon what you thought they should have said or shouldn't have said or should have done or shouldn't have done? We all live under the tyranny of the shoulds. It's called socialization. But how much of our socialization comes from explicit norms within a given culture versus the norms we embraced based upon the shoulds of life? The shoulds of life, I believe, come from our mind. Our mind is the part of the brain that interprets the information coming in and operates on fear, often reacting based on the shoulds of life, the manner we think we should be to be liked. How does what happens when younger affect us later? What part of the human puzzle does our neurology and genetics play? Our genetics determine the structure and how our brain works. And of course, the environment plays a role. The two operate and develop in tandem. From conception through the first couple of years in life, perhaps till now, you have been affected by your caregivers. Those are the people who've perhaps conceived you and raised you. During this time, we develop our current emotional brain circuitry, which is really another way of saying, how do you feel? How do they register inside of your body? Do you feel your feelings intensely? Do they frighten you? Are you even aware of any of your feelings? Or do you know any of the coping mechanisms you have to cope with your feelings? What is your emotional relationship with the world around you? This emotional circuitry starts as dirt roads in your brain. These roads are developed by nature, one or both parents, and how our caregivers nurture us. The part of the brain that feels emotion is operating off of cues in our external environment. The more we can understand the relationship between the two, the more we can understand why we do what we do. The brain has an extraordinary amount of something called plasticity. You can be born and nurtured to be one way, and you can learn to have a different type of emotional temperament. You can intervene and change your emotional reactions, learning how to use your whole brain. Our emotional circuitry is the road our brain automatically goes to when stimulated. This stimulation we call our feelings, our emotions. Our emotions are our internal stimulation in relationship to what's happening outside of us. That information, that electrical stimulation, and the relationship between the two, it tells us everything. That electrical stimulation can come from any one of our six senses, and they are our cues about what to do next. We inherit this brain architecture. We are raised by our caregivers, and then by the world. The human brain physically is divided into two parts. Stuff between our ears, a small amount of cauliflower, the brainstem, cerebellum, pons, and spinal cord. This is our original brain. The cauliflower part is our modern brain. These areas of our brain are distinctive, yet intimately connected. The limbic system is a part of our original brain. It is where our emotion is first felt. Our limbic system is our emotional alarm center. This is how our brain drives us, but we can learn to drive ourselves, gaining control over our alarm center, our limbic system. Having more control over our alarm center, it can allow us to feel, and when we feel, we can gain a greater sense of self-control and well-being. It all starts with being aware of oneself, being open to self-examination, what is really motivating us, what is happening in the moment, how does all of this fit into the context of who I am, what can I learn? So what is this limbic system? A neuroscientist named Jane Pepez proposed that we had an emotional circuitry that ran through the hypothalamus. He then identified specific structures that were part of our emotional circuitry. These structures are the amygdala, the emotional alarm center, the thalamus, the relay center, the hippocampus, the memory, the cingulate gyrus, the first layer of the cortex, the olfactory bulb, and the hypothalamus. The amygdala is sized and shaped like an almond. It is located deep in the brain toward the middle, right below the earlobe. You have two, one on the right, one on the left. Like most parts of the brain, there is a pair. The primary function of the amygdala is to operate as an alarm system to alert us to danger. The only coping strategies of the amygdala are run, fight. The amygdala, by way of chemical messengers, can stimulate portions of the brain that stimulate the body. When we perceive anything that stimulates the fear, the amygdala will send chemical messengers that act in a cascade manner. The amygdala initiates this alarm system and ultimately stimulates the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus stimulates the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland stimulates the adrenal glands. The adrenal glands make cortisol, which elevate blood sugar, and adrenaline, which give us run energy to fight or flight. Each chemical messenger stimulates the next like dominoes falling upon each other. This circuitry is called the HPA axis. That is because all parts, the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the adrenal glands, work together to cope with whatever stress one perceives. Have you ever had a thought in your head create a sense of anxiety? When this happens, you feel threatened and you go into survival mode. Our sympathetic nervous system takes over and we get ready to run or fight. This is the stress response. Like dominoes falling, one reaction stimulates the next, and then it all goes feeding back to the source, the hypothalamus. This feedback is intended to stop the hypothalamus from signaling that danger is around. This feedback system, however, stays elevated for long periods of time, when it's only meant to be available for short periods. Because it's in your cortisol will circulate in your system for 18 hours, it's easily to get reactivated. And prolonged reactivity has damaging effects upon us. Elevated cortisol will depress our immunity, it suppresses bone growth, and affects many bodily functions. This is why stress kills. One effective way to decrease stress is by using our whole brain, not just the stuff between our ears. Learning how to prevent our original brain from driving our behavior. The amygdala initiates a sympathetic nervous reaction, and we just react and react. This is where activities like meditation, breathing, and paying attention to patterns in one's life can pay off. Meditation reduces anxiety by keeping us calmer. Breathing slowly and gently and directing our attention away from the situation that's producing anxiety, learning the patterns and triggers that are setting us off, these are all ways to cope with anxiety and to prevent it from happening. Our modern brain, what are these lobes and what do they do? Our largest lobe is our frontal cortex. It is often thought of as the thinking part of the brain. This is where emotions are processed, where we make interpretations as to the sensory stimuli coming in. The sensory stimuli can be from any one of our six senses: smell, vision, hearing, touch, taste, and my favorite, intuition. Our parietal lobe allows us to see in 3D, to imagine things in our mind that we can't readily see. It is thought that Einstein had an enlarged parietal lobe that might otherwise help him develop the theory of relativity. Our parietal lobe has allowed us to see things in space and create instruments like GPS. Our occipital lobe allows us to see things, to determine what we're seeing and what we're perceiving in any given moment. The most amazing thing about our occipital lobe is we can close our eyes and envision things in our mind eye. For example, if I close my eyes, I can envision Ella Fitzgerald singing "How High the Moon," as I recall her singing that in a YouTube video. Our temporal lobe, that is where memories reside. We understand what we hear, we decipher language, and begin to understand what's occurring outside of us. Is there danger? Where is that danger coming from? Our own thoughts? Or is it in our environment? An example of stressors coming from our own mind is, for example, you're at the airport one time, and for some reason there's a problem with security. It looks like you're going to miss your flight. You have a complete meltdown. Later, upon reflection, you realize that this experience reminds you of a childhood memory where you were late and missed a birthday party. You plug back into the memory, which is another way of saying your body remembers this feeling and begins to behave the same as you did then. Your body will hijack you, take you over, and make you react. You can learn not to react. You do so by paying attention to what you're feeling and how you're acting in your day-to-day interactions. You might find you feel tension in your throat, your chest, or other body parts. This often happens when we feel we have to defend ourselves and our actions and explain ourselves. Ask yourself, how does this fit into your life? What has happened like this? What is your interpretation of this experience? All of this can help you understand the meaning behind your day-to-day interactions, but it starts with being open, allowing yourself to feel, connecting with your inner guidance, your wisdom, your intuition, the signals of your pineal. The pineal is located in the middle of your head, straight back between your eyebrows. The Egyptians called this the third eye. I believe being open, following my intuition, that has allowed me to guide my life, telling me what to do and when, and reflecting on how my inner voice will then tell me what to do next. All I have to do is listen. Lastly, the two areas of significance that radically changed the course of human history are the Broca and Wernicke areas. They gave us the ability to speak and understand language. With language, we created culture. The world we see around us is a result of these two areas getting larger and being wired. This happened not very long ago, only 40 to 70,000 years ago. Please join me for my next podcast when I discuss how I discovered my intuition, block universe theory, string theory, and the pineal gland. For now, please enjoy a poem I have written for you. You are. You are nature. You are energy. You are love. You are a spiritual being. You're an emotional being. You're a physical being. Most of all, you're a human being becoming a humane being. Namaste. Be well. Until next time. Bye now.